This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You know the drill. It's you, me, a room with the top experts, 28 minutes, and one of the big issues of the day. Today, it's Afghanistan and the unprecedented possibilities right now for peace. But can you really do business with the Taliban? Afghanistan has been called America's longest war. But even the 19 years that NATO troops, including British personnel, have been there seems short compared with the 40 years of suffering of the Afghan people themselves. There have been 6,000 civilian casualties so far this year. But now, genuine peace talks are underway involving the Afghan government and the insurgent Islamist Taliban. But is Taliban 2020 an outfit that you can do business with? Is it peace thereafter or victory? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Almost miraculously, delegations from two sides involved in a horribly violent struggle in Afghanistan are sitting down and talking to each other in the Qatari capital, Doha. I want to know first how that came about and what's at stake. The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has been reporting from Afghanistan for more than 30 years, long before the Taliban even existed. Lise Doucette, why to a British listener can we say that Afghanistan still matters?
Remember September 2001? Remember the attacks of September the 11th when world leaders, including the British Prime Minister, stood next to other Western leaders and the Afghan leader and said, "We are with you for the long run. We are standing shoulder to shoulder." Well, the long run still isn't over, even though the majority of British and other NATO forces left in 2015. Of course, they decided then that they had given enough to the war, and Britain certainly did give a lot to the war. More than 400 British soldiers or members of the civilians working for the MOD have been killed. But I think, if anything, the COVID-19 crisis has told us yet again that we live in a world where borders don't matter that much. The majority of the heroin which ends up on the streets of Britain comes from Afghanistan. Many of the migrants who try to reach our shores are also Afghans trying to flee what seems like a war without end. So we can't just simply stay in our bubbles, stay within our borders and say, it doesn't have anything to do with me.
So now let's talk about the agreement reached between the US and Taliban in February in Doha, and you were there. What was the atmosphere like?
A real sense of history. A real sense, especially for Afghans, of daring to hope that this could be the beginning of the end, of an end of a war, which still, every day, not a day goes by without a life being taken somewhere in Afghanistan.
So what were the key elements of the talks? Why were the US and the Taliban able to reach an agreement in February?
Well, senior American officials will say, well, we're pulling our troops out. We've been there long enough. And NATO forces, the rest of the NATO forces say, well, we went in together. We'll leave together. And they came up with a deal which has conditions. It's a phased conditional withdrawal of the last of the US and NATO forces. Most of all, they want the Taliban to give guarantees that it will not be, that Afghanistan will not be a safe haven again for terrorist groups, for Al-Qaeda, for Islamic State. But also the Taliban committed to start talks with Afghans, with a delegation from Afghanistan.
So essentially the trade-off was, we take our troops away, you commit yourself to no safe havens for terrorists who might attack us, plus you also agree to talk to the Afghan government about a longer-term peace. So that was essentially the February agreement. Now, to what extent, as far as we know, have these agreements been adhered to? I mean, obviously there has been a reduction of US troops, correct?
Even as we speak, American troops are packing up. We were there in September and October. We visited some of the American bases and saw what was left of some American equipment, you know, treadmills and dartboards and et cetera, the real junkyard of history. Because President Trump announced recently in his last weeks in office that he wanted the troop numbers down to 2,500 by mid-January. So they are following that, even though in the U.S. Congress, they're raising doubts. They're saying, just a minute, our main interest in all this is whether or not we are going to be safe. We don't believe the Taliban are keeping their provinces or will ever keep their promise to ensure that they don't give refuge to Al-Qaeda. So the drawdown is continuing, but there are now red flags coming up.
But one side of that has been kept is that now the Taliban have indeed agreed to talk with the Afghan government. Can you tell us how significant that concession is?
That was such a day. A really historic day for the two sides to sit across a huge table. It was in the most glittering of ballrooms in the Gulf state of Qatar, one of the wealthiest per capita states in the world, to discuss finding a way out of the world's dirtiest war. Afghanistan is now regarded as the most violent conflict in the world. And the people sitting on the two sides of the room, this was not just political for them. It was personal. Young Afghans whose fathers were assassinated by the Taliban, Afghans in their 20s and 30s, at the table trying to end their father's wars. On the other side of the Taliban side of the table, they too have lost people in these wars. Everyone has lost someone.
Because you've been in Doha and you know the individuals involved and you've seen how they're evolved, what I'm interested in is the question of what their positions are as well. I mean, what is it your impression that either side will settle for and their objectives actually are?
You hear from the optimists that the Taliban recognize that they cannot try to rule as they did in the 1990s. A harsh rule which banned girls and women from going to school, which whipped women when they went out into the streets, women couldn't leave their homes, a pariah state. The optimists say that the Taliban say, and I've heard them say this, that they have to have an inclusive government. And then they say, we have changed. We are not the Taliban of the 1990s. We too have evolved. And we too understand that we need to have an inclusive government if we are to have peace in Afghanistan, and also if we are to get the aid that we need from countries around the world. But the pessimists say, and some of these pessimists have been sitting at this table for months now with the Taliban, and I've heard it from them myself, the Taliban haven't changed. That while, for example, they say that Afghan women will be given all the rights that they are given within Islam, they won't be ready to recognize the changes that Afghan women have gone through in the 1990s. Women just don't want to leave their home now. They want to, they're CEOs of companies, they're government ministers. They think of running for president. Even women in the rural areas don't want men to be dictating every part of their lives. And also you hear from the Taliban, we won this war. We won it. So it's not a question of us joining you. You come and join us. And they say, we were unlawfully ousted from power in 2001. You've had 20 years to put Afghanistan back on its feet. And look at Afghanistan. 90% of Afghans still live on less than $2 a day. It's our turn to get into power. And whether we do it on the battlefield or whether we do it at the table, it's the Taliban time now.
Lisa Sett, and she'll be back later. But now I want to know who the Taliban are. The images from the 1990s are familiar ones. No music, no kite flying, no girls' schools and public executions in the football stadium. I'm joined now in the briefing room by Ursula Naymat. She's the director of a Kabul-based think tank, the Afghan Research and Evaluation Unit. Ursula Nemat, you were in Afghanistan during Taliban rule in the late 1990s. What do you remember of that period?
I was in Afghanistan for only brief periods. I was a war refugee in Pakistan during late 90s. I left Kabul in 89 when I was 10, 11 years. Returning 10 years onward, I found the city like a ghost city, full of dust, lots of distractions. People they seemed to me very unclean in terms of, you know, their hygiene and everything. A lot of men with long beards, all women obviously covered by burqas, and everyone seemed quite stressed. This wasn't the Kabul that I left back 10 years ago.
And to what extent then were you aware of the Taliban as an organization and as a government?
Well, I was aware of the Taliban as an imposed government because they were controlling the city when I was there. I had to make sure to have my uncle with me everywhere I was traveling. So without a close male relative, we could not move from point A to point B. This was the time, 98 I'm talking about, when I visited many relatives after, you know, returning back to the country. And then I realized that particularly women and girls were extremely worried to be threatened in terms of their education in the future. For me, it was a shocking thing to see because I myself, when I arrived in Pakistan, I was deprived of education for the first year. And I remembered my own feeling of fear of what will happen to me if I become an illiterate. My mother was a teacher. My father is an architect. I come from an educated family. And I saw in the eyes and in the faces of all these girls the same kind of fear that I had back in those days.
Coming up today, to what extent do you feel the Taliban is the same organization that it was back in the 1990s, the organization that imposed strict Islamic law?
You know, we have to move on from the absolutism. I understand that political groups or even insurgent movements, they keep evolving. The sad news about the Taliban is that any changes I see is to worse. Today's Taliban is an image with further terror, with further fear that they are causing, with further threat to humanity, regardless of their identity of who these humans are. When they target civilians, when they target, you know, civil society activists, this is something that scares me more than the time that I was running those classes 20 years ago.
What kind of support do you think the Taliban has in Afghanistan now?
In my opinion, they are trying their best to portray themselves as the traditional Muslim Afghans. This is the picture that somehow tricks our international friends and allies because they appear with their long beards, with their traditional dress. But the matter of fact is that when it comes to local support, people don't support the Taliban. Taliban are a force of fear. People are scared.
Now, to what extent does the Taliban control parts of Afghanistan at a local and regional level, as far as you know?
Afghan communities are self-governed. Now, the Taliban do have influence. The Taliban do have some level of control over some communities, some even districts maybe. The Taliban's influence in certain communities and in one service that's make them somewhat popular among local communities is their delivery of justice. Afghan justice system is really time-consuming and corrupt, unfortunately, and that sometimes leads people who have some land dispute or other source of disputes to approach to the Taliban, who have the Sharia-based courts. They have someone who goes there and makes a decision and executes the decision in the shortest period. And that somehow gives the Taliban some sort of popularity. The Taliban, within the larger movement from province to province, district to district, I am confident and sure that there are people who are genuinely aiming for ending this war and finishing these atrocities all over the country. The matter of local leadership of Taliban should be seen in a very through a contextual lens, meaning it can depend. In one area, maybe there is somebody who is sympathizing with people, who has support of the people, because people would be suffering in that area probably from a monstrous militia, a pro-government commander, and vice versa.
Now, you create a picture of an organization which is actually quite diverse. So it does rather raise the question in one's mind about the extent to which the leadership of the Taliban, the people who are negotiating in Doha, are actually in touch with and have control of their own commanders in the field.
The two examples of ceasefire days, although for a short period of time, 3 days or so, they have demonstrated that the top leadership of Taliban has a level of control over their ground forces.
Now, as far as you understand it, should the Taliban either come to power or come partially to power as a result of an agreement, wanting to run the place?
In an ideal way, it will be a situation where they can come and be part of any arrangement, any future political settlement, let's call it, and together, like handing over their guns and handing over their violence, together with the rest of the Afghans, collectively decide about the way to lead the future. The same way we, as forces on the other side of the Taliban, are accepting them despite their, you know, atrocities, despite the grave violations of human rights that they have committed all these years. They should also accept us as a reality. By us, I mean, you know, the Afghan people, the Afghan civil society, the Afghan women who are making a huge advancement in the political leadership.
Ursula Nemat, it's often been said that the only thing preventing a total Taliban victory is the presence of the US military. There were at one point 100,000 personnel in Afghanistan. At the beginning of this year, there were 12,000. Now, as a result of the February agreement, there are even fewer, but their presence is still significant. So how do the Americans see the peace process? Joining me now in the briefing room is Annie Pforzheimer. She's a former US diplomat whose last job in Kabul was as deputy head of the US mission until 2018. Annie Pforzheimer, how confident should the US be that the reduction of troops that it has agreed won't simply end up in victory for the Taliban?
Well, the reductions are plural. There are reductions in the force that go towards zero, but they are not yet guaranteed to go to zero until certain conditions are met. I think in this case, though, we, the United States, would be well advised not to go to zero, not to do what the current president has been advocating, because this remains a point of leverage.
So does that mean that what you're saying is there are sufficient US and other troops in Afghanistan to ensure that there isn't a victory by the Taliban?
So the people who are defending the constitution and the government and the people against the Taliban are Afghans, primarily the Afghan National Security Forces. But it is important that there is some kind of U.S. and international presence which is helping to back up those forces. And so, yes, I think that a small number of troops compared to the very large numbers that were there 8 or 9 years ago, that still is very important because the Taliban have been pushing the government and have been conducting violence against civilians. They don't show any sign of stopping.
What would the US see as the optimal outcome of the Doha talks?
The idea, I think, is a political roadmap towards a stable and constitutional order, something that people see as fair and reflective of their interests and that protects the rights of all Afghans.
Does it matter how long this actually takes?
In my opinion, it does not matter how long it takes. People have to switch gears from years of focusing on war to the fact that peace can take years as well. We all have to have strategic patience because the product that we're looking for is one where it is stable enough that the international community never has to return.
It would seem to be very difficult to achieve a peace with the sheer level of violence that you see going on in Afghanistan.
The violence that we see is fairly controlled. We have proof that, for example, the Taliban was able to turn off the violence for the period of a ceasefire that they held in June of 2018 and at other points as well in the conflict. So the level of violence does not necessarily mean that peace is impossible. One party of the conflict has decided that violence is in their interest. There are other sources of violence, such as terrorist groups and criminal groups. And so that will continue to be a problem even if a fulsome peace accord is reached.
Now, some people might think that the capacity of particularly the Taliban to turn on and turn off its violence may not be the most promising thought to go into peace talks with. And it does beg the question very slightly about what the real US interest is in Afghanistan. Is it now restricted to making sure that Afghanistan is not a launching pad for terrorism against the United States and others? Or does the United States have a wider concern for the Afghan people themselves?
In terms of the US interests, this is a very difficult neighborhood of the world where there are nuclear-armed states. There's a rising China, there's Russian domination of Central Asia. These are all strategic problems the U.S. faces and doesn't want to face alone. So the best outcome is an Afghanistan that remains an ally. And then over and above it, we have an interest in the successful outcome of Afghanistan's effort to recover from its decades of war.
Where would human rights sit in the middle of that concern? A lot of people remembering the Taliban of 2001 recall the use of the football stadium to execute women prisoners and so on. Is the US able to tolerate a return to anything like that as long as the US is not under threat?
The question of whether we are under threat should not be the only consideration. But I do understand that, you know, governments have some cold-blooded choices to make occasionally. We want a stable Afghanistan. Human rights is essential to a stable outcome.
Now, does the US election result change things with regard to US policy towards Afghanistan?
There will be, I believe, continuity in support for the peace process. There will be, I assume, an assessment of the American troop presence, what we're trying to do and how many people it requires. And I think that they will take the agreement between the US and the Taliban into consideration, but look closely at the conditionality of that agreement. There's not a rush to leave if the conditions are not met. We have a new president-elect who has a great deal of experience with Afghanistan and is being very cautious in his public pronouncements right now.
Now, let's imagine that there is a peaceful conclusion, but that within that peaceful conclusion, there is a significant Taliban presence within governments in some way or another. Can the US do business with a Taliban-influenced Afghan administration?
The specifics of doing business, you know, would vary, but the donor community made a very clear statement about international assistance a couple weeks ago, that there must be a settlement that protects the rights of women and minorities and obeys rule of law and international obligations. And if Taliban are part of a government that does all of those things, then yes, we, the donor community, can do business. But if the Taliban influence erodes the protections of human rights and freedoms, the international community has clearly stated that they should not expect assistance.
And does that constitute, in your mind, the main leverage that the United States and the wider international community would have over such an administration?
It's one of the most important points of leverage. Afghanistan's economic situation is such that international assistance is a very important piece of leverage.
Annie Pfortzheimer. So what's likely to happen in Doha now? Will the fragile opportunity for peace be taken? The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in constant touch with the various delegates there, and she's back with me. So let's come to the talks now, Lise. Can you encapsulate for me what's happening?
So they were launched officially, formally, in a great burst of publicity in September. Very historic, very emotional. Enemies sitting for the first time face to face across a table. And there was a sense of, wow, this is, you know, what a ray of hope. And among the government, the people who had come from Kabul on the delegation appointed by the Afghan government, you know, in the early days, almost all of them said to me, wow, this is going better than I thought. But that kind of optimism quickly gave way to some real fears when they sat down to discuss what they thought would be pretty banal sort of discussions about rules and regulations, like we start with prayers, we end with prayers, we're nice to each other, we don't shout at each other. Instead, the Taliban threw some political grenades in there to discuss what kind of Islamic law should govern the talks, that the American deal should be regarded as more important, and then which led to real sense among the government negotiators that the Taliban hadn't changed at all, that this was a sign that these negotiations were not going to succeed. But they eventually got over that. They finally agreed recently those rules and regulations. They found compromises. Now they're discussing the agenda, which is another minefield.
So as we go forward with the talks, what are the issues that are likely to be most difficult to solve? And I realise I risk a laugh of an ironic laugh at that point.
The biggest issue of all is what will be the power sharing. Is, you know, how much power do the Taliban want? Do they understand this is sharing power? They have a totally different political system. They have, but it's probably in some ways more similar to Iran, they have an emir, their top Islamic leader. And there is, when you ask them, they say, oh, it's too early to discuss this. But they talk about an Islamic council. Will they insist on having their emir? And what will be the relationship between their Islamic emir and a president? Can these be resolved by simply setting up new councils and committees? Or is this going to strike at the very heart of what kind of Afghanistan will emerge if and when this war ever ends?
Lise, you describe a very, very complex position, to say the very least, and a very uncertain one. And yet these peace talks are completely unprecedented for Afghanistan, aren't they really? So what is your prospectus? What is your expectation for the year or couple of years ahead in Afghanistan?
So many, most of all Afghans, are holding their breath. They are hoping against hope that these talks will succeed, that when the last of the US-led NATO forces leave, that the country won't collapse into chaos. But every single Afghan or outside leader that I spoke to in recent months with the last question, what is your greatest fear? They all said, we are fearful that history will repeat itself, that Afghanistan will again plunge into the terrible civil war which followed the Soviet withdrawal in 1989. When I was in Kabul, there was a real sense on the government side that, yes, we are talking peace, but we are also preparing for war. The cynics will say that next summer there will be a terrible summer war. The optimists will say, well, the talks will continue. The Afghans will try to find some, we'll find a modus vivendi, even if we have to government control in one area or Taliban representatives in another. It hangs in the balance.
Lise Doucette. And my thanks to her, to Ursula Nemat and Annie Fortzheimer. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirsty Knight. The editor was Jasper Corbett. The programme was mixed by Gareth Jones. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Last week's was a one-hour special on whether Britain was ready for Brexit. Other episodes have looked at various aspects of the pandemic, and on the international front, the treatment of the Uyghur people in China and what's happening in Belarus.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.